is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, it's scary to hear that there's an outbreak of COVID at Matop. I'm really shocked. I don't even know where to start.
That's Moses Moyo, the parent of a student in Zimbabwe's Matabeleland region. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopian government troops are preparing an assault on the Tigray regional capital, Mekele. And a Democratic Republic of Congo court sentences a former militia leader to life in prison. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United Nations Security Council is meeting today to discuss the fighting in northern Ethiopia as federal government troops prepare an assault on the Tigray regional capital, Mekele. The UN human rights organizations and governments around the world have urged both sides to halt the fighting and protect civilians. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has told the Tigray People's Liberation Front to surrender by Wednesday or its forces encircling Mekele will attack. The government today said Tigrayan soldiers were surrendering as federal forces advance. However, the TPLF leaders say its troops continue to resist and have destroyed an army division. They denied Ethiopian claims to have Mekele surrounded. Nearly 3 weeks of fighting have sparked a refugee exodus, caused hundreds of civilian deaths, and raised fears of broader instability in the Horn of Africa. Abiy ordered troops into Tigray on November 4th in response to an alleged TPLF attack on federal military camps. The federal government says the conflict is limited offensive aimed at certain members of the TPLF. The TPLF, which governs the region, says Ethiopia has launched a war on the people of Tigray. Egypt signed a $65,000 a month contract with an American public relations company to provide government relations and strategic counsel to Egypt ahead of the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. The outreach to the new U.S. government comes as Egyptian police arrested top members of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights after they met with 13 European ambassadors to brief them on human rights conditions. They were charged with supporting terrorism and spreading false news. Said Sadiq is a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the Egyptian lobbying effort.
As you know, Egypt understands the American foreign policy making process and the various actors involved, including the Congress, public opinion, the role of the professional lobbies and PR companies in influencing public opinion and Congress are important. This is not, by the way, a new development. Egypt has always, like many other countries, are using PR companies and lobbies to protect their interests, to promote policies and advance their interests. And you want to influence U.S. lawmakers. Egypt institutionally is strong with the White House and the Pentagon, the CIA, but not with the Congress. And so this is very important for them. This point of weakness, they need to fill. This also shows you that the Egyptians understand American policymaking process and would like to be active and not passive in reacting to a policy they are not involved in influencing.
Earlier this month, Egyptian police arrested top members of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights after they met with 13 European ambassadors to brief them on human rights situation in Egypt. They were charged with supporting terrorism and spreading false news. What could an American public relations company do to fix the negative impact of such an action?
They have to ask the Egyptian government to help their work by being more transparent about the charges and fast clearing up this case, because as it drags on, it will cause a lot of negative portrayal and negative coverage. So this is the first task this PR company has to do. Otherwise, of course, it would be difficult for them to keep the image of Egypt in a positive way.
The Washington Post has called Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi the most repressive ruler in Egypt's modern history for his crackdown on independent journalists, political activists, and civil society organizations. Would the Egyptian government adopt a different approach as President-elect Biden pledges to revive U.S. support for democracy and human rights around the world?
It seems that President Sisi has a different strategy. He is concentrating on economic development and might be seeing pro-democracy and human rights activities as unnecessary agitation and distracting noise, wasting time. Why? The Middle East regimes in 2021 are not the same as in 2011. They are more ready to resist any American intervention and have been grouping together in alliances against such attempts. If you look at the alliances between Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Bahrain, and Israel, they are preparing to resist any attempt that would not be serving their interest. So it's highly unlikely that Biden, who has a full domestic agenda and other foreign priorities away from the Middle East, would risk strategic cooperation and arms sales with these regimes to serve the demands of a fragmented, weak opposition by pressing Sisi. We have to remember that Sisi withstood and survived many pressures in the last 7 years. Moreover, Egypt has many alternative friends like China, Russia, Israel, and Gulf State to resist the pressures from the progressive element in the Democratic Party. Also, many regimes and large sectors of the people in the Middle East see the issue of human rights as being manipulated by the U.S. government to blackmail them to make certain concessions. The U.S. has also a tarnished democracy promotion image, not only because of Trump's ruling style and election problem, but even earlier with many examples. When the U.S. turned a blind eye and abstained from raising the issue of Saudi women's right to drive cars, but they were only busy selling them weapons. What about the plight of the Palestinians? All those issues make any attempt by Biden to talk about promoting human rights and democracy in the Middle East not very successful discourse.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. A commission of inquiry has filed criminal charges against former South African President Jacob Zuma for refusing to testify before it. The commission is probing allegations of widespread corruption when Zuma led the government between 2009 and 2018. Investigators say Zuma conspired with political allies and corrupt business people to steal billions of rands from state enterprises, which the former president denies. Darren Taylor reports.
34 witnesses have implicated Zuma in graft. He's also scheduled to go on trial next year for a slew of financial crimes. The former president has long argued for a chance to defend himself in public, but whenever he gets the opportunity to do so, he keeps quiet or falls ill. Last Thursday, Zuma went a step further when he walked out of proceedings.
It's quite clear that Mr. Zuma flouted the summons, lawful summons that had been issued to him to give testimony to the commission.
Lawson Naidu is director of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution.
And he's walking out without the permission of the Deputy Chief Justice amounts to a criminal offence in terms of the Commissions Act. And on conviction, one is liable to a fine or a period of imprisonment or both.
Shortly after Zuma's walkout, his foundation issued a statement saying he'd rather go to jail than be bullied by an irregular, manipulated, and unlawful process. Zuma has alleged the commission is biased against him. The president of the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, Mvuzo Notyesi, describes the wording as irresponsible, provocative, and ridiculous.
One recalls President Jacob Zuma was the one who set up this commission and urged every South African to cooperate. He stated very well that he had confidence in judges of the Republic of South Africa and did not doubt their independence. All of a sudden, when the decisions of the commission do not favor him. The foundation has an audacity to attack the institution that is set up in terms of the law and to undermine the integrity of the commission.
Zuma's supporters argue he's within his rights to refuse to testify at the commission, based on the precedent of former apartheid president P.W. Botha refusing to appear before South Africa's Truth Commission in the 1990s. This is a spurious position, says Notyesi.
You can't be right to commit an unlawful act simply because it was previously done. So there's nothing to compare here. We must focus on the fact that former President Jacob Zuma walked out of the commission, and that is a contemptuous behavior. Let's not involve side issues and irrelevant.
The commission will also approach the Constitutional Court with regard to Zuma's latest behavior. A very shrewd move, says Naidu.
I think it's seeking to circumvent a long, drawn-out legal process where if they were to go to the High Court, we'd have a series of appeals until the matter ends up in the Constitutional Court. By going directly to the Constitutional Court, they're seeking to try and fast-track this and get a decision from the Constitutional Court that makes it absolutely clear that Mr. Zuma has to respect and respond to a summons that is issued to him.
The commission has only 30 days left to run, according to law. There are indications that Zuma will employ his legal team to block his appearance by various means, including declaring that he's sick from undisclosed illnesses until the commission's mandate simply expires. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
When Zimbabwe's government relaxed the COVID-19 restrictions, schools reopened in late September. Now, COVID-19 cases in the country's Matabeleland region are spiking, which teacher unions say vindicates their opposition to schools reopening. The country has seen about 9,200 COVID-19 cases with about 270 deaths. Arigando gives us more on the story.
Last week, the Zimbabwe Education Ministry officials revealed that about 100 pupils at John Tarlac High School in Tabazinduna in Matabeleland North tested positive for COVID-19. The number has since risen to at least 145. Matopo High School in Matabeleland South is the latest school to be quarantined after 10 COVID-19 cases were recorded. Although the government phased in school openings and staggered class attendance, parents and teachers' unions have voiced concerns about returning to class. They said COVID-19 safety preparation was inadequate and they feared for teacher safety. Moses Moyo is a parent with two children at Matopo's High School in the Matopo's World Heritage Area in Matabeleland South. He says even the teachers' commutes to and from school risks exposing pupils to the virus.
You know, it's scary to hear that there is an outbreak of COVID at Matopo. I'm really shocked. I don't even know where to start. To be frank, I'm actually stuck as a parent. I don't know where to start. I don't even want to talk about government, because government is the one responsible for everything. Right now, they open schools without putting anything in place.
Through unions such as the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, teachers have called on government to stop reopening schools until it can provide protective equipment and set up adequate COVID-19 preventative measures for teachers and students. Takawafira Joe is the president of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, PTUZ.
The situation in schools is pathetic. We have received the cases of COVID-19 in all the 10 provinces except Mashonaland and the East. The other 9 have had schools where cases of COVID-19 have been reported. And we really wonder where the government's purported more than 600 million towards COVID abatement equipment is gone, because it is clear that it is not filtered to schools.
Joe's union has been locked in a protracted battle with the government over pay and working conditions, says there is no COVID-19 protective gear and that many schools across Zimbabwe face serious challenges such as lack of running water, face masks, and no social distance. Teacher Sarah Dube describes the situation at a school in Gwanda, the capital of Matabeleland South Province.
For example, at my school, is that there is no running water, which on its own is a health catastrophe there is a bucket of water at the gate, and learners, together with the educators, wash their hands only when entering the school gate. Whatever activities that happen during the lessons, there is no running water or any sanitizers available for the learners. Again, no fumigation of the schools as required by the WHO guidelines were done. Honestly, I think we are brewing another wave of COVID-19 in these schools.
The government has said it will start investigating the use of COVID-19 prevention funds. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
A military court in the Democratic Republic of Congo has convicted Ntaberi Sheka, a former militia leader, of crimes against humanity and sentenced him to life in prison. According to the French news agency AFP, Sheka was convicted of murder, rape, sexual slavery, and enlisting children under 15 years old. The United Nations hailed the trial, which lasted 2 years, as a blow against the impunity of armed groups in the country. Sheka founded the Nduma Defense of Congo, or NDC, militia, which was active in DRC's restive North Kivu province, where he claimed to be fighting Rwandan Hutu rebels. After evading arrest for years, Sheka turned himself in to UN peacekeepers in July 2017 and was prosecuted along with three co-defendants. A new report from the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned of growing consequences for children as the COVID-19 pandemic heads into a second year. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
Even before the current fighting, at least 54,000 children lived in refugee camps in the Tigray region and 36,000 were internally displaced by natural disasters and armed violence. Access into Tigray is now restricted by the fighting and communications are blocked, leaving an estimated 2.3 million children unable to reach humanitarian assistance. James Elder is a UNICEF spokesperson for Eastern and Southern Africa. He says the conflict in Tigray has put numerous stress on the health and psychological well-being of children.
In the Sudan, which is already going through its own challenges, it already has a lot of refugees. So they arrive there hungry, thirsty. We, of course, also have a global pandemic. As I say, some of them are traumatized because of what they've seen, whether it's because they've seen bombs or whether it's because they've seen family members injured. So as always, any child who is fleeing an area of conflict is under enormous stress.
Ethiopia's federal government launched an offensive on the country's northern Tigray region 3 weeks ago, saying it was in response to an attack by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which governs the region. The Ethiopian government says it is a limited military action against some members of the TPLF, while the TPLF leadership says it is a war against Tigray. Elva says UNICEF and other UN agencies need to gain access into Tigray and work without fear of attacks to improve access to water, sanitation, and hygiene services. Elder says his organization is working to ensure children get vaccinations and plans to begin a polio vaccination operation next month. Both sides need to keep children safe and not recruit them to fight. Elder says and children should be protected from sexual and gender-based violence.
Going to need to be on the ground, the United Nations, UNICEF, providing that nutrition, providing that emergency sanitation, making sure people have access to water. A lot of the water supply in Tigray requires sort of, you know, diesel pumps and so on. So got to make sure that there's fuel there. Cutting off a water supply can be catastrophic. So they're all the sudden emergency things children now need, as well as psychological support. We're getting children arriving in refugee camps in Sudan who've lost their parents.
Elva says his organization and other UN agencies fear the number of refugees crossing into Sudan to seek refugee was just the beginning, as there are concerns that the Tigray violence will escalate.
What UNICEF urgently needs at this point is to get access into Tigray to make sure we can reach those people as well, where there's, you know, more than a million children, we believe, who will need some form of humanitarian assistance. So as with all conflicts, whilst as long as it continues, the more likely we're going to see civilians and children suffering and fleeing.
Elder says UNICEF was particularly alarmed by malnutrition rates in the region, noting acute malnutrition increased by one-third between 2019 and 2020, largely due to the desert, locust infestation, and the COVID-19 pandemic. He says without sustained humanitarian access, many more children will be at risk, as malnutrition treatment supplies in the region will last only until December. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Kenyan doctors are threatening to go on strike in December if the government fails to address their safety, health insurance, and staffing needs to fight COVID-19. The threat to paralyze medical care in Kenya comes after at least 10 doctors died from the virus this month. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan doctors are threatening to go on strike next month unless the government addresses their concerns about safety, health insurance and staffing needs to fight COVID-19. The threat comes at least 10 doctors died from the virus this month. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi Tuesday, the Secretary General of the Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union, Chibanzi Mwachonda, said his members plan to go on strike because the government is not giving them medical insurance.
If these doctors are not covered, then this strike will kick off until the time that they will be covered.
Kenya has lost 32 medical workers to COVID-19, at least 10 of them in the last 2 weeks. The deaths have angered medical workers. Watende Andrew lost his young brother to the disease. His late brother, a doctor, worked at the University of Nairobi. After 7 days in the hospital, he died.
I think because of other comorbidities, he was in the category of severe disease. He got the best attention we could, but still, I think because of comorbidities, then he developed hypoxia, saturations which were low, and when they were trying to intubate, then he passed on.
Doctors also complain about not receiving adequate personal protective gear. The union says all their requests are met with silence. Recently, President Uhuru Kenyatta opened a new health facility with 100 beds for United Nations staffers and the diplomatic community. Meanwhile, some Kenyans say they were turned away at health facilities and advised to take care of themselves at home. Mwachonda is calling on the government to employ at least 2,350 doctors and medical workers to attend to the sick in various hospitals across the country.
There is an acute shortage of doctors in this country in each and every county, and our demand is that each county must employ at least 50 doctors to cover for COVID and for the other services. If this is not addressed equally, we shall be on strike come the 6th of December.
The Kenya Nurses Union has also issued a 14-day strike notice. The union is demanding compensation for the families of 18 nurses who died from COVID-19 and salaries for some nurses who have not been paid for months. The head of the National Assembly Health Committee, Sabina Chege, said Kenya cannot afford to see doctors not working during this challenging period.
It's not a unique situation where doctors are feeling they are not being taken care of by the government. And, you know, at what point do you say it's optimal or it's enough? It can never be enough, but people can try, and we can't really manage everything. Let's look at what is the priority. What can we be able to do for now? What can wait for a month or two? Then we can have an agreement. I don't think the fight or the strike will solve anything. We'll lose more lives, and nobody is safe.
Kenya has recorded 77,800 coronavirus cases and 1,400 deaths since March. A parliamentary committee will meet Wednesday with county governors and other officials to discuss ways to avert the strike. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Yehius. behalf of our producer, Mokmi Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.